Random House Audio presents Parlor Games by Marika Biagio. Read for you by Leslie Carroll. A single bad act no more constitutes a villain in life than a single bad part on the stage. The passions, like the managers of a playhouse, often force men upon parts without consulting their judgment, and sometimes without any regard to their talents. Upon the whole, then, the man of candor and of true understanding is never hasty to condemn. Henry Fielding, Tom Jones. The Trial. You be the judge. Menominee, Michigan, January 22, 1917. I believe, dear reader, and these words come from the bottom of my heart, that I can truly trust you. Look at yourself. You've sought out my story. You're willing to hear me out through these many pages. Who but a worldly and curious soul would undertake such a journey? Why, already I discern in you the intellect and refinement of a person with an open heart and nimble mind. You and I, my new friend, will become well acquainted over the course of this tale. But you'll want me to proceed with the telling. That's what you've come for, and I'll not thwart your wishes a moment longer. So choose your favorite spot. A divan in a sumptuous hotel suite. The leather chair in front of your blazing fireplace, or a sun-soaked bench in a sculpture garden. Any place, really, where we might enjoy the luxury of uninterrupted time together. And I will tell you the tale of the most dangerous woman in the world, or so the Pinkertons dubbed me. Today was the first day of my trial in the booming metropolis of Menominee. I narrowed my attire choices down to an indigo dress or a modest black dress with fluted collar. Looking at the black dress, I thought, heavens, it's no funeral, and donned the blue one. It hugged my torso in a becoming manner, but still struck the serious and formal note required of the occasion. I kept my jewelry to a minimum, a simple sapphire necklace and matching earrings. The carved gold bracelet the Baron gave me on our first wedding anniversary, and my 3-stone diamond ring with garland filigrees. As much as I love my jewels, this was no time for ostentation. With the trial slated to open at 2 p.m, my brothers and I enjoyed a leisurely luncheon at home. Then Paul drove us through swirling snow to the courthouse in his 1916 Apperson Jackrabbit. He's so proud of that car, with its spruce green exterior and leather seats as comfortable as a sofa. But then his automobile business does stock the latest models in the Upper Peninsula. I believe, Paul, I observed from the back seat, that Mr. Apperson has taught Henry Ford a thing or two with this car. Jean, who sat beside me, said, taught him how to build the most expensive thing on wheels is what he's done. I chuckled. Jean and I fell easily into the sport of teasing our older sibling, and added, now if only you could find a buyer for it in Menominee. Paul pivoted his blocky head in my direction. If I get the chance to sell it. I resented Paul's insinuation that he stood to lose property in the lawsuit. After Papa's passing, Paul had ordained himself head of the family, even though the best he'd ever managed was a lumber worker's salary. That is, until I financed his automobile business. In truth, the responsibility for substantial support of the family had always fallen to me. I reached over the front seat and patted Paul's shoulder. You needn't worry. Have I ever let you down?
You're coming damn close, said Paul.
Oh, don't make it harder than it already is, Jean said. None of us likes being dragged to court. I could always count on Jean to take my side whenever Paul goaded me. With a winking nod to Jean, I said, I'm sure it will all come out fine. Everyone should have a brother like Jean. He's as loyal as a musketeer, always ready to serve up merriment, and dashing to boot. Today he sported a trim, charcoal-gray suit. Paul wore a baggy black jacket and shiny with wear wool pants. Jean, at 6'2", surpasses Paul in height and carries himself as erect as a proud stallion. Jean has the sort of looks that beguile women. Twinkly blue eyes, a shapely mustache, and tawny brown hair. Paul, stouter of build, and perpetually glum, has only managed to attract a dowdy wife who disdains the revelry Jean and I naturally fall into. How perfectly provident that Jean, and not dull Paul, was named after our charming father. Paul eased up on the accelerator as we rounded the corner onto Ogden Avenue. Wagon and car wheel ruts grooved the snow-packed streets, and our car jostled over the ridges, bouncing us up and down on our seats. Between buildings and in storefront cul-de-sacs, a gusting wind played the snowdrifts, skimming snow off their thin peaks and carving them into lopsided mounds. The drying cold of winter that hangs in the air, even during a snowstorm, pricked my bare cheeks and neck. I clutched the folds of my moleskin coat against its bite. We approached Foster's Dry Goods, and I spied Mr. and Mrs. Foster standing as still as mannequins, gazing out the window. As we drove by, the couple stretched their necks to study us, making no attempt at a greeting. Jean leaned forward and gripped Paul's seat. "Look at the Fosters admiring your car." Paul trained his eyes straight ahead.
"More likely trying to spot our notorious sister."
"Well, you're wise to drive this car around town," I said, intent on nudging Paul back to some measure of civility. "Surely it's good for business." "Not that Menominee offers much by way of business. I've seen cities all over the world. Chicago, sparkling and booming after the Great Fire. Portland, brash as the Wild West. Shanghai, steeped in trade and mystery. And London, civilized and regal. This town, however, has bust written all over it. The sorry storefronts, bleached as ashen as driftwood. Many of its once booming lumber mills shuttered. The ice-encrusted shores of Lake Michigan impassable for months on end. And the surrounding forests, once thick with white pine, nearly all logged out. All in all, a rather pitiful place. As for me, I'd rather roast in the Mojave than live in Menominee. The only good thing that comes of being stuck here for this trial is the chance to enjoy my brother's company. We parked beside the courthouse among a hodgepodge of tin lizzies and horse-drawn wagons and carriages. The piebald mare, only a few feet away, drooped her head as snow collected in splotchy blankets on her contoured back. At the slamming of our car doors, she neither budged nor blinked. The poor thing. What a shame that this trial forced her to endure such numbing cold. Positioning myself between Paul and Jean, I hooked a hand under each one's arm, and they escorted me through the front door and up to the second-floor courtroom. Paul opened the door, and I stepped forward. Townspeople had absolutely mobbed the courtroom, to say nothing of the 8 to 10 newsmen with writing pads at the ready. As we walked in, heads turned and followed us. On the water-stained wood floor, snow melted and puddled around the onlookers' feet. Coats, gloves, and farmers' boots gave off wet wool, stale dirt, and manure odors. The pungent brew tickled my nose. I swept my wrist under my nostrils to supplant the stench with my jasmine perfume.